This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Hope you're having a terrific Thanksgiving weekend. Glad you decided to tune in today. If you're a regular listener, welcome back. If you're a new listener, this is where we talk about what's happening out there in the economy. We look at today's economy in the context of historical economies that have existed, and we make a forecast based on what's happened historically. In other words, we believe your history professor was right. Those who don't study history are doomed to repeat it. And on today's program, I'm going to carry on that theme. On the fourth segment of today's program, I'm going to talk to you about economic seasons, economic cycles that we believe repeat themselves. And we're going to talk to you about which asset classes tend to perform best in each cycle. Certainly valuable information, we believe. In the second segment of today's program, I'm going to examine the relationship between stocks and gold. It's something that's not often discussed. I also want to quickly remind you that we do have a special one-night Social Security information seminar coming up. It will be held on December the 9th at 6 o'clock. It will conclude at 7:30 with a complimentary dinner. Seats are filling up very, very quickly. You'll want to respond in the next few days if you want to attend that meeting. There's a special announcement posted at newretirementrules.com if you'd like to check it out. The website, again, is newretirementrules.com. And also, if you'd like to get our investor's kit, which contains the book New Retirement Rules, all you have to do to get that is to visit the website, investingapproach.com. The website, again, is investingapproach.com. Just let us know where you'd like us to mail that kit. We will be glad to get it out to you at no cost or further obligation. So again, information on the discovery kit is available at investingapproach.com. I am pleased to have as a first-time guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. Philip K. Howard. He is a well-known leader of government and legal reform in America. His new book is The Rule of Nobody. His TED Talk has been viewed by over 500,000 people. Philip is also the author of bestseller The Death of Common Sense, The Collapse of the Common Good, and he is also the author of Life Without Lawyers. In 2002, Philip formed Common Good, a nonpartisan national coalition dedicated to restoring common sense to America. Mr. Howard also writes periodically for the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and the New York Times. He's also appeared on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, The NewsHour, Today, Good Morning America, Charlie Rose, and numerous other programs. And Mr. Howard, welcome to the program.
Nice to be with you, Dennis.
Well, let me ask, just to start out, give us the premise of your latest book, The Rule of Nobody.
The premise of the book is that we're looking at the failure of government in the wrong dimension, that it's not mainly that we have terrible leaders or even necessarily a terrible philosophy, of regulation versus deregulation. It's that the law has piled up so much that it's impossible for anyone to do anything sensibly. If George Washington came back and was put in the White House, he wouldn't be able to build new infrastructure because the procedures take 10 or 15 years to get through before you can do anything. So if we want to fix this system and restore people's freedom to make sense and use their common sense and do what's right and run a classroom and do balanced budgets and all of that, we're going to have to clean out this legal jungle that, for the best of intentions, has, grown up over the last four or five decades.
So, Philip, how did we get here? What was the tipping point? At what point historically did we get to a point that, in your view, nothing can be accomplished unless we clean up this legal jungle, to use your term?
I think it was a confluence of two things. One is the world's gotten more interdependent and crowded, and so the demand for government oversight to make sure nursing homes are good and daycare centers are safe and the air is clean and all that, it's gotten greater since the 1960s. But we have this kind of early industrial age rigid model of government where we think law should be like cast iron manacles. We should tell everybody exactly how to do everything. And the more government gets involved in our daily lives one way or another, again, often for the best of intentions, the more these iron manacles are put on everyone and nobody can get anywhere. And we just have to recognize that that if you want modern government to work well, it's actually going to have to be a lot simpler, and you're going to have to let people take responsibility to try to get the job done and focus on how to hold them accountable or to have checks and balances rather than this kind of bad form of central planning where we make everybody go through the day with their noses in thick rule books.
So, Mr. Howard, it just seems to me that with a lot of the special interests that seem to control Washington, just from my perspective, that while a lot of the reforms, and I want to dig in and talk in some detail as to the reforms you'd advocate, well, they all seem like they're probably good ideas, and certainly common sense is something no one associates with Washington. Is it possible to make some reforms with entrenched as so many of these special interests are?
Well, that's a very good question. The answer is both no and yes. We're not going to make these reforms by saying pretty please to Washington. Washington is completely dysfunctional. I have a section in the book called Washington is a Deviant Subculture, and it's not meant to be funny. I mean, literally, the values just have nothing to do with the values of the society of the rest of America. But the way change always happens in Washington, it happened in the 60s and the 30s, in the Progressive Era, in the Civil War, the way it always happens is pressure from the outside. So what we're trying to do, what I'm trying to do, I've got a board of people like Bill Bradley and Al Simpson and, you know, a lot of very respected people, is we're trying to begin to change the public narrative about the need for a fundamental spring cleaning. You know, really a big deal, a historic event where we go and clean out government and put humans in charge again, so that then when we elect somebody or appoint somebody, we can actually say, are you doing a good job or not? Because today, you know, you say, well, who's responsible for the budget deficit? You know, well, nobody. Who's responsible, you know, for not building, for the fact that we can't rebuild our infrastructure? You know, nobody.
Well, if you're just joining us, we're chatting with Mr. Philip K. Howard, who is the author of The Rule of Nobody. And Mr. Howard, when we talk about this organization, Common Good, and I read through the advisory board names, and it's literally a who's who. I mean, Howard Baker, Bill Bradley, Thomas Keene, George McGovern. I mean, just huge. How would someone learn more about your work?
Well, they can go to commongood.org, and it's, you know, free, and they can sign up and be on the mailing list. And look, for example, right now we're doing a project where we're studying all the legal constraints for rebuilding infrastructure in America, and that includes 10-year environmental reviews, multiple permitting in state, local, and federal government, you know, literally, you know, scores of permits or hundreds in some cases. Really rigid rules on government spending money, and lots of special interest favors. Like, for example, people who wave flags, you know, at a construction site. If that's funded by the federal government, even in part, there's a rule that says you must pay them almost $100 an hour when the market is $20 an hour. So, you know, there's just all this stuff piles up. It doubles the cost of infrastructure, and it takes it four times as long to get approval to build it. If we could just change the words of the law in each of those areas I mentioned, we could hire 3 million people within 3 years.
What an impact that would make, just economically speaking, not to mention in other areas. You know, we've got about a minute and a half left or so in this segment, Philip. Let me just jump in and talk about one of the reforms championed by Common Good, and we may have to pick it up on the other side. You've talked about a concept called special health courts. Could you expound on that?
Sure. So in America today, you know, doctors are so scared, rightly so, that any sick person might get sicker, you know, that they practice defensive medicine. They order tests that aren't needed. We all see it. And it's hard to measure, but estimates have it wasting between $50 and $200 billion a year. And it also makes care worse because doctors and nurses are trained not to use their peripheral vision to say, are you sure that's the right dosage, that kind of thing, because they don't want to take legal responsibility. So the way to fix that is to make justice reliable, not have it be an ad hoc system. So we, in a partnership with the Harvard School of Public Health, came up with a proposal to build to create expert health courts who wouldn't have juries, that have written rulings. They would take less than a year versus 5 years for a regular justice system. People who were injured would be more reliably paid. They wouldn't get rich, but they would get their compensation. And doctors would be affirmatively protected when they didn't do anything wrong. That's the idea, to make justice do what it's supposed to do, which is to be reliable. And pretty much everybody's for it. Obama came out for it. Romney was for it. Most editorial boards are for it. And the trial lawyers hate it because, for them, the prospect of maybe winning $10 million is like extortion, right? So they like to hold that, sort of axe over the head of doctors, but it's just terrible for society. It's terrible for patient safety, and it's terrible for the cost of health care.
Well, that's about the end of this segment. We're going to have to leave it there. We're chatting with Mr. Philip K. Howard, and we'll continue our conversation with him in the next segment when Everything Financial Radio continues. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I'll continue my conversation with Mr. Philip Howard in the next segment. You know, if you listened to last week's program, you probably learned a bit about a couple of alternate asset classes that we think folks ought to consider in this economic environment. Much of the financial industry takes what I like to call a one-bucket approach, meaning that they recommend stocks and bonds as the only two asset classes that you own. Maybe a little bit of cash, but in the brokerage industry, there is a saying that's at least tossed around internally that says cash is trash. So stocks and bonds are typically what you'll see many brokers and financial industry advisors recommend that you invest in. And you may have heard the rule of thumb that the older you are, the more money that you should have in bonds. Well, in the last segment of today's program, I'm going to talk a bit about that rule of thumb. I'm going to talk a bit about how different asset classes perform in various economic seasons. But we like to use in this environment what we call a two-bucket approach, meaning that there's two other asset classes that you might consider for your portfolio. Now, of course, all this is driven by your own individual facts and circumstances, so I'm going to talk today just in a general sense. One of those asset classes is cash. Another of those asset classes is precious metals, often just gold and silver. Now, on last week's program, I talked about the fact that if you look at the ultra net worth folks, the ultra high net worth folks, if you look at the folks that have a net worth of $30 million or more, there was a story that reported on a survey that was taken, and these folks, on average, have about 25% of their assets in cash. Now, a study of history will tell you that in difficult economic times, having assets in cash is not a bad thing. In fact, many of the folks that got very wealthy during the Long Depression of 1873, like Andrew Carnegie and John Rockefeller, had a lot of assets in cash. Now, if you're looking at gold, how much of your assets should you have in gold or silver or precious metals? Well, again, generally speaking, in an ideal world, arbitrarily speaking, you might have about 10% of your overall portfolio in precious metals. Now, historically speaking, precious metals have performed well in an inflationary environment, but they've also done well in a deflationary environment. And as we've discussed on past programs, private sector debt levels today are very, very high. And when private sector debt levels are very high, in fact, today they're higher when measured as a percentage of the economy than they were prior to the beginning of the Great Depression. That high level of private sector debt is deflationary. Now, if we go back and look at the last economic winter season of the 1930s, a period of time that we all know as the Great Depression, it was illegal to own gold. So it's difficult to know what the actual market price of the metals was. However, if we want to take a look at how gold did while the stock market was plummeting, we could possibly go back and extrapolate the performance of gold during the 1930s by observing how gold stocks performed. Now, there was a mining company called Homestake Mining that was a leading publicly traded mining company when the economic winter season of the 1930s hit. In May of 1924, which was smack in the middle of the economic autumn season, a period of time that we know historically as the Roaring Twenties, shares in Homestake Mining sold for $39. At that time, the Dow Jones Industrial Average stood at 90. That might be a really difficult number for you to believe, given the level of the Dow today is approaching 18,000. But in 1924, the Dow stood at 90. By the market peak in August of 1929, that was about 5 years later, the Dow had risen to 380. So it went from 90 to 380. It had more than quadrupled. Homestake Mining also saw its shares rise from $39 a share to $90 a share during that time frame. So the Dow's gains on a percentage basis doubled the gains of Homestake Mining stock. Now, deflation kicked in. That's when the story changed. Deflation, again, typically emerges when private sector debt levels are high, and stocks don't like deflation. In fact, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell to 42 by the time the stock market bottomed. Let's look at the math. 380 at the peak, 42 at the bottom. That's a decline of about 90%. And incidentally, when you look at the break-even curve, and this is really important to consider, especially if you're getting close to retirement, the break-even curve simply calculates the level or percentage gain that's needed after a percentage loss to get back to even. So to give you an example, if you have a 50% decline in your portfolio, you need a 100% subsequent gain to get back to even. If you have $100,000 in your account suffers a 50% decline, the $100,000 balance drops to $50,000. 100% gain on $50,000 gets you back to the $100,000 level. A 50% gain gets you only back to $75,000. Well, when you look at that break-even curve and look at what percentage gain is needed to get back to even after a 90% decline, it's a 900% gain. So if we go back again and just look at what Homestake Mining did during this time frame, the Dow dropped from 380 to 42 for a decline of about 90%. During that same time frame, Homestake Mining share price rose to 528. That's a gain of 486%. Now, given that we're confident from our study of history that we're going to see inflation moving ahead, given the high level of money creation in which central banks are engaging, or we're going to get inflation followed by deflation, we think precious metals are an essential portion of our bucket two assets. Again, not a lot of assets are required to hedge a stock portfolio, if history is any indication. And again, just because something happened in the past doesn't mean it's going to happen in the future. But these economic cycles have existed for really 2,500 years. So if you take a look at Homestake Mining and go back and look at these numbers, Homestake Mining went from $90 a share all the way up to $528. That's a 486% gain. It didn't take much in gold mining stocks to hedge the decline in the Dow. So one reason to think about adding gold to your portfolio, and again, a moderate amount of gold. If you're talking to a gold broker and the gold broker suggests that you have 30% of your assets in gold and they want you to buy rare coins, I would be very, very cautious. On the other hand, 10% of your portfolio, give or take some, depending on your personal facts and circumstances, might make some sense. Now, we talk about what kind of gold to buy in the book, New Retirement Rules. It's my book that was released a couple months ago. And if you'd like to get a copy of that, I'd like to invite all the listeners here on this Thanksgiving Day weekend to go ahead and request our free Investor's Discovery Kit. That Discovery Kit contains the book, New Retirement Rules. A lot of the information I just covered here in this segment is covered in the book. And we also talk extensively about what type of gold you might consider adding to your portfolio. The book is included in the Investor's Discovery Kit, as well as an educational DVD and an educational CD. You'll also get a copy of the New Economy magazine. The Discovery Kit is absolutely free. All you have to do to get your copy is go to the website, investingapproach.com. The website, again, is investingapproach.com. And just enter your name and where you'd like the discovery kit to be mailed, and we'll be glad to get it out to you. Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. I have the pleasure of chatting today with Mr. Philip K. Howard, who is the author of the book, The Rule of Nobody. And Philip, before I jump back in again, the last segment we did, enjoyed the conversation very much. If someone wants to get your book, where is it available?
Well, I think, you know, you'd get it, certainly get it online readily. And big bookstores will have it. It's probably generally available.
Terrific. Let me ask you, I want to go back in and talk about the idea of health courts, which certainly from a common sense perspective makes a lot of sense. And you've mentioned that President Obama's for it, Romney's for it. If everybody's for this, is this something that's going to get done fairly soon, or is it something that maybe is down the road a ways?
Well, it's down the road, you know, but I talk about this in The Rule of Nobody. Change in democracies rarely happens by small ball. You know, you don't get a good reform here and then a good reform there. People say, just fix this. You know, that isn't how it works. It happens in big gulps, again, like the 1960s or the Depression. You know, that's when change. And so people have to come to the realization that this system is broken. It isn't broken just in one way or another. It is broken in every way. And so, you know, you wander into a hospital, it's not, you know, this, it's, you know, lawyers, the doctors go through the day with a little lawyer on their shoulders, right? You can see it when they're talking to you. As one doctor said, I see every patient as a potential plaintiff. And I sort of guard my words. You wouldn't want to say something off the cuff that might be used against you. Imagine going through the day thinking like that. You know, it's so counterproductive to good healthcare. But it isn't just that. Then he spends 30% of his time filling out forms and complying with regulatory stuff, much of which is completely immaterial. So you have a situation where physicians, who used to be the most honored professionals, now only 6% of them say they're satisfied with their job, and about the same percentage said they wouldn't, you know, only that many would recommend that their children go into the profession. So it's become this profession of the dispirited when it used to be the most honorable profession because of this legal structure we put on top of them.
So you'd made a comment. I thought it was a great line. It said, change happens in big gulps. And in order for there to be change, from my perspective, you've got to have the electorate, if you will, or society that really cares or wants change. And I've interviewed a number of folks, and I happen to agree that there seems to be a general apathy in the country. Do you share that view? And if you do, how do you see that whole thing, whole attitude as a society changing?
Well, I'm not sure it's apathy. I think, you know, one of the problems is America's suffering from the same, I call it passivity, that goes along with being affluent, you know, and fairly wealthy. People work hard. Most people still have jobs. They have two cars. They have flat-screen TVs. And fixing Washington seems hopeless, right? So why bother? And I'm not sure it's so much apathy as it is you have a system, a democratic system that's kind of dysfunctional, where people sort of understand it really doesn't matter much who you elect, because once they get into office, you know, they get into office with slogans like change you can believe in, right? And then they get in the office, they don't do anything. But I argue it's not really. I mean, I don't think President Obama's been a great leader, but frankly, you know, it isn't mainly his fault, because he doesn't have the authority to do very much. So, you know, the way change is going to happen is that people are going to have to get scared or angry. It's not, you know, right now people are not so scared. They're apprehensive. People, you know, sort of global warming on one side and debt piling up and that, but people aren't really scared or angry. And what the political scientists say is it's when that moment happens, there'll be some event that's impossible to predict where it's like the dike will burst. And we're going to have a decade like the 1960s where there's just a lot of momentum for change all of a sudden. But we don't have a vision of what that change should be.
So what
we're doing at Common Good and what I do in the Rule of Nobody is I present a vision of how democracy could actually work, that people could get up in the morning and make choices to fix the infrastructure and run the classroom and spend most of their time taking care of patients instead of wasting it on bureaucracy. But it's a vision where human responsibility is at the top of the pyramid again, not hundreds of thousands of pages of law.
Makes a lot of sense. We're chatting today with Mr. Philip K. Howard, author of The Rule of Nobody. And Mr. Howard, let me jump in and kind of expand on something you just mentioned, and that is restoring teachers' authority to maintain order. Expand on what you would advocate there as far as reforms are concerned.
It's amazing what's happened to schools. I mean, bureaucracy is piled up on top of teachers, like sediment in a harbor, between filling out the forms and the formal procedure. So if you want to, we did a study of all the legal steps required if a teacher wants to send a student, a disruptive student home in New York City. It required 66 possible legal steps and considerations, including several levels of legal appeal. You're not sending the kid to jail, you're sending him home.
Unbelievable.
So there should be a radically simplified model of discipline where without any legal process whatsoever, there's a place in the school, for starters, where disruptive students with somebody to supervise it can go, but where they can be removed from a classroom immediately, because if a kid's disrupting a classroom, nobody can learn. It's just that simple. So you really can't tolerate it. Because it destroys the learning of everybody.
So when you see the 66 steps, that just is remarkable to me. And when you start listening to this, I'm reminded of an interview I did with Jim Babka, who is the president of Downsize DC, and they're advocating that there is actually a law passed that requires Congress to read the law or listen to it being read out loud before they vote on it. So to what extent are all these legal steps part of these monster legislative bills that arguably maybe congressmen voting on or congresswomen voting on these bills don't even know what's in them?
Well, this raises another point. Law is not supposed to be an instruction manual. It's supposed to be like a corral. So the Constitution is basically 10 pages long. Right? The Affordable Care Act was 2,700 pages long. That's crazy. The Interstate Highway Bill, which authorized the construction of 41,000 miles of roads, were completed within 14 years after passing the bill in 1956, was 26 pages long. The most recent Transportation Act and there were no regulations. The most recent Transportation Act was 584 pages long, then followed by thousands of pages of regulations. And so what's going on here is we actually are unwilling to give any official the authority to make choices to implement a goal. We're trying to lay everything out in writing and tell them exactly how to do something. A couple of years ago, a tree fell in a creek in Franklin Township, New Jersey. It caused flooding. The mayor sent in a backhoe to pull it out. Then the lawyer said, oh, no, that's a Class C1 creek, whatever that means. And in order to remove any natural object, including this tree, you have to get official approval. Well, it took them 12 days and over $12,000 in legal fees to get approval to do what was completely obvious, to pull the tree out of the creek. So imagine that scenario for every little thing that government does. And then you get laws that are so dense that nobody in Congress could possibly know what's going on.
So how do you get these old laws off the books? I mean, one of the reforms that your organization, Common Good, advocates is sunsetting old laws. Comment on that, and how do we do that?
Okay, this is really important because, you know, we take law seriously, like it's the Ten Commandments, but at this point it's the 10 million commandments, right? So it's one thing to have a timeless principle like the First Amendment or principles of contract law or something, but most regulatory laws are just social management programs. It's someone's idea about how we should do something that's needed, like take care of disabled children, say, with the special ed laws. They will always have unintended consequences, always. And so special ed laws now consume over 25% of the total K-12 budget in this country. There's nothing for gifted children or early education. You know, it's mad. It's literally a form of legal mental illness. We spend all the money there. So we have to have a mechanism to clean out old laws. But the problem is our founders made a mistake. They didn't realize it would be much harder to get rid of an old law because it has these army of special interests around it, right? If you try to change the special ed laws, the parents will chain themselves to your door or whatever. So we need a mechanism, and I think it's constitutional, that every law with budgetary impact has to expire periodically, and it cannot be renewed until there's been a report of an independent committee and a big public debate over whether and how it should be renewed. It's just a really missing part of the American constitutional structure.
Well, our guest today has been Mr. Philip K. Howard. He is the author of the book, The Rule of Nobody, generally available. I'm sure you can check it out at Amazon.com. I would also encourage you to check out his organization, Common Good, at commongood.org. And Mr. Howard, it's been a pleasure having you on the program today, and we'd love to have you back. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, yeah, great. A wonderful conversation. Thanks, Dennis.
Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen, and thanks to our special guest today, Mr. Philip K. Howard, for joining us. You know, I want to talk in this segment, as I have in the second segment of today's program, as well as on last week's program, about different asset classes. And in this segment, I really want to focus in on how different asset classes perform in different economic cycles. Now, if you've been a longtime listener to the Everything Financial Radio program, you know that it is our belief that economies cycle, and these cycles tend to repeat themselves, and each one of these sub-cycles takes about 15 to 20 years to complete. Now, when you look at the approach that much of the financial industry takes, it's my opinion that a lot of folks who invest using a one-bucket approach of just stocks and bonds will find that in an economic winter season, like the one we find ourselves in now, their portfolios may not perform as well as they had hoped. In fact, many of them may actually experience significant losses. Now, for purposes of explanation in this segment, I am just going to start with a couple of very basic definitions that are probably going to be old news to many of you. But just so that if we have a new listener or someone that's new to investing, they understand exactly what I'm talking about and why, let me just basically define stocks and bonds. These are the asset classes that are, again, often used by the financial industry. Stocks are really just ownership shares in a company. When you own a share of stock, you own a piece of a business. If the business is profitable and grows, your stock may become more valuable. On the other hand, if the business fails, you could lose your entire investment. Now, bonds are really just loans made to companies. When you own a bond issued by a business, you've loaned that business money. Businesses issue bonds or get loans from investors for any number of reasons. They might be building a new factory. They might be investing in equipment. Maybe they're just retiring old debt. Now, bondholders' interests are secured by the assets of the business. In other words, the loan you make to the company is collateralized by the assets of the company. If a business fails, bondholders may recover some or all of their investment. It depends entirely on the assets of the company. As you now know, if you've been listening to the program for the last couple of weeks, history tells us that it would be wise to use more than just the two traditional asset classes like stocks and bonds, typically recommended by many one-bucket financial professionals, particularly during an economic winter season. Now, let me go back and just look at, quickly in this segment, the prior economic seasons and how asset classes have performed in each season. Now, the last spring cycle, we believe, occurred from 1949 to 1966. This was just after World War II, And the economic spring cycle, to define it, is characterized by a gradual increase in business and employment. Consumer confidence gradually increases. Consumer prices begin a gradual increase compared to levels seen during the prior winter cycle. Stock prices rise and reach a peak at the end of the spring cycle. Credit gradually expands. That means people are starting to borrow money again, and bankers are starting to loan money again, and overall debt levels are low. Now, if you look at the spring cycle from 1949 to 1966, you see that the Dow actually began the spring season at a level of about 150 and ended at about 900. So that's about a 600% increase. On the other hand, in an economic spring cycle with interest rates rising, bonds tend to perform poorly, as typically you find that the relationship or performance of bonds is inverse to the direction of interest rates. So as interest rates go up, bonds and bond funds tend to go down. So if you have a one bucket approach during a spring cycle and you're using only stocks and bonds as assets in your portfolio would perform relatively well given that stocks are rising pretty significantly. On the other hand, gold, which typically moves inversely to stocks, tend to perform poorly during an economic spring cycle. And of course, cash is always a positive asset. It's just that in some economic cycles, it tends to be more positive than others. Now, if you look at an economic summer season, which we believe occurred in the United States from 1967 to 1982, stocks really experienced almost no gain from point to point. In other words, there was a 15-year time frame during which stocks point to point did nothing. In fact, if you look during that time frame, the bear market of 1973 saw the market actually correct about 50%. So not only did stocks not do much point to point for 15 years, if you own stocks, you also experienced a lot of volatility. Now, during an economic summer season, and I'll define that for you here, there is an increase in the money supply in a summer season, which leads to inflation. Gold prices reach a peak at the end of the summer period. Interest rates rise rapidly. You might remember in 1982, the early 80s, interest rates were significantly high. In fact, the prime interest rate got to 21% at one point. Stocks are under pressure and decline through the period and reach a low at the end of the summer cycle. Now, interest rates rising rapidly means that bonds don't do too well either during a summer cycle. Cash continues to perform well, especially given the environment of rising interest rates. And gold is king of all assets in an economic summer season. Gold is arguably the king of inflation hedges. It does well as the money supply expands during the summer cycle as overall debt levels are low. In 1971, gold was $35 an ounce, and it was in 1971 that President Richard Nixon eliminated the last link between gold and the U.S. dollar. And by the end of the summer season in 1980, gold reached a record high of $850 per ounce. See, if you had used a one-bucket approach, just stocks and bonds in your portfolio, you would have had significant losses potentially. Looking at cash and gold as assets in your portfolio as well, you could have done actually quite well. From the summer season, we move to an autumn season. Now, the autumn season that followed the summer season actually occurred, in our view, from really 1982 through 2000. Now, if you remember that time frame, you know that stocks did really well, bonds did really well, and gold performed very poorly. Now, let me remind you of our autumn season definition. During autumn, money is plentiful and gold prices fall, reaching a gold bear market low by the end of the autumn season. Gold actually went from a high of $850 an ounce down to approximately $250 an ounce. If you owned gold during this time frame, you didn't do very well. On the other hand, if you look at the S&P 500 during this time frame, the S&P 500 began at about 150 and it ended at about 1500. So the S&P 500 and stocks in general went up about 1,000% during this autumn season. You probably also remember during this autumn season in the time frame from 1995 to 2000, Tech stocks did incredibly well. In fact, we saw, if you look at a chart pattern, an almost straight up chart pattern on the S&P 500, as well as the Dow and the NASDAQ. Well, massively positive stock action is typical of an economic autumn environment. Now, during an economic autumn environment, again, to give you the definition, money is plentiful, gold prices fall, there's a massive stock bull market, there's a lot of speculation, financial fraud is prevalent, real estate prices rise significantly, debt levels are astronomical, and consumer confidence is at an all-time high because stock prices are up, real estate prices are up, and jobs are plentiful. Everybody's working. Now, cash accounts during this autumn season are positive, just not quite as positive as during the prior summer season because interest rates are falling during this time frame. So stocks and bonds do really well. Gold does poorly. Cash does not quite as well. Now, when you go to the winter season, and if you look at a winter season definition, the economy experiences a crippling credit crisis and money becomes scarce. Financial institutions are in trouble. Just think back to the financial crisis. The too big to fail banks, in fact, many of them were bailed out. Those too big to fail banks, according to the data I'm seeing today, are bigger than they were at the time of the financial crisis. And derivative exposure, derivatives were really one of the big causes of the financial crisis. Derivative exposure is now 20% greater. So there's some very suspect data surrounding financial institutions today. To continue with the winter season definition, there are unprecedented levels of bankruptcies at the personal, corporate, and government levels. There's a credit crunch, and interest rates begin to rise. Now, we haven't seen that here in the United States, but certainly a number of European countries have seen that already. There are pension funding problems, and the price of gold and gold-related equities rise. One needs only to take a look at the recent Detroit bankruptcy to see that we are in a winter season. Now, keep in mind these seasons last a period of 15 or 20 years, and markets never go straight up or straight down. So when you take a look at the stock market during this winter season from 2000 to the present, the stock market values, nominally speaking, are higher. But when adjusted for real value, when adjusted for the purchasing power of the dollar, stocks are not any higher. The dollar has been significantly devalued by the Federal Reserve by massive money printing. In fact, if you look at the dollar index, the dollar has lost about a third of its purchasing power in the last 14 years against the other six major currencies that belong to countries that the United States trades with. So in a winter cycle, we expect that stocks and bonds will be negative. We expect that gold will be positive. In fact, if you look at gold, gold has gone from $250 an ounce all the way up to about $1,200 an ounce, and gold has been as high as $1,900 an ounce. We expect that the Dow to gold ratio, which you obtain by taking the value of the Dow and dividing by the price of gold, that's currently somewhere between 14 and 15. Our forecast is that that number will get back to somewhere on par, about even or a ratio of 1 before the end of the winter season. So we think looking at alternate asset classes and using a two-bucket approach is something that a lot of folks should consider in this environment as opposed to the standard one-bucket approach that uses only stocks and bonds that much of the financial industry would have you use. If you'd like to learn more, I would invite you to get our Investor's Discovery Kit. It's yours for free by visiting the website investingapproach.com. The website, again, is investingapproach.com. All you need to do is let us know where to mail that discovery kit, and we will be glad to do that. Again, the website, investingapproach.com. That's our program for this week. Thanks for listening.